I want to change directions quite a bit with regard to the lesson this evening and talk to you about something that at least I found a bit humorous to illustrate some points that I want to make from the book of Daniel. You may want to be turning to the book of Daniel. That's where we're going to take our study this evening. It's going to be a fairly simple study. I'm going to talk about the Daniel plan. Has anyone heard about the Daniel plan? There are some nods in the audience about that. Actually, we're not going to talk much about the Daniel plan. We're going to talk about a different plan that is found in the book of Daniel. But some of you may be aware of a book. It's actually a weight loss book that was co-authored by Rick Warren and a couple of medical doctors. This is a book that is designed to cause individuals to lose weight through a combined diet and exercise plan. There is the blurb, if you'll notice the second bullet up on the board. The Daniel plan shows you how the powerful combination of faith, fitness, food, focus, and friends. Isn't it just wonderful that there are F's for every single point he makes? It's called alliteration. And people like to use that to make a point. But faith, fitness, food, focus, and friends will change your health forever from the inside out. You read the blurb from this particular book, and Rick Warren, who is a denominational preacher that heads up a very large church, I think it's called the Saddleback Church, if I remember correctly, in California. It's over 15,000 strong, and of course he has TV programs. He is one of those preachers that have had a number of appearances during elections and political commentary with regard to the various presidential candidates. He's probably the closest thing that comes as a replacement to Billy Graham in our modern time. But very influential individual in, I guess, in our society, at least a certain segment of our society, who decided one time after he had, he said, baptized in a single day 800 people. 800 baptisms in a single day. I wish. I would love to do that once. If it breaks my back for an entirety, I would be willing to do that for a day, to baptize 800 in a day. But he decided that he was out of shape after baptizing 800 people, needing to lose weight. And so he mentioned that in his next sermon to the congregation and said, I'm going to lose weight and I want you to take the pledge to do it with me. So this is his sermon. And expecting a couple of hundred people to take him up on it, turns out 15,000 people did, and they lost a total of 260,000 pounds. Now, you can go on Amazon.com, or perhaps go to a bookstore, and you can buy the book, The Daniel Plan, based upon, or at least the title, based upon, I haven't looked at the book, so I don't know what it's based upon, but the title is based upon the text of Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8. You'll remember when Daniel and his young friends were taken into Babylonian captivity, that the requirement was given to these, the best and brightest of Judah, to be fed at the king's table and partake of the king's delicacies, and to show themselves as robust and healthy before the king to please him. And we're told in verse 8 of Daniel chapter 1 that Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies. And so there were prohibitions that were given to the Hebrews concerning this. He was not going to be unfaithful to God. And so he determined not to do that. Not with the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. So this is where that book comes from, the diet plan, or the Daniel plan, this particular diet book. And by the way, you go to Amazon.com and you look it up, and they will not only sell the book. Understand this, a preacher who's selling the book, and by the way, this book was declared the Christian Book of the Year by the Evangelical Christian Publishers Association. So all of the evangelical books on every single topic, biblical topic, all of the teaching that was done, this book, which is a million bookseller, million copies sold, but this was the Christian Book of the Year. And in this, you can go there and you can not only buy the book, but you can also buy a package of DVDs with an exercise plan and the aerobics exercise that goes along with it. You can buy t-shirts and jackets, both in men and women's styles, a sports bag, a sports towel, a stainless steel water bottle. That's why it's $20 instead of $10 or somewhere around that. And a jumpstart guide to make it easy to start the program. A music CD with music to listen to as you're doing the exercising. And they even have one of those little rubber, like the Live Strong bracelets, a little rubber Daniel Plan bracelet that you can wear to show everybody that you're taking part in the Daniel Plan. This is considered, in fact, a Christian ministry or an aspect of his ministry. This is very typical of what you see in the religious world today concerning the willingness to put the term Christian as an adjective just about upon every single thing you can possibly think of. So this might would be the equivalent of a Christian diet plan, perhaps. And there have been others. This is not the first by any means. It's simply the latest in a long line. Of course, the word Christian has been used in many other ways. In fact, you look at that phrase that the Evangelical Christian Publishers Association at their annual banquet gave to this book, the Christian book of the year. Christian book of any year, if we're going to ever use the adjective for anything, would be God's Word. But that's, again, somewhat typical. Now, the point that I want to make by way of illustration, this is not what the sermon's about, but that what Rick Warren has done with this book is take a money-making enterprise, has no place with the adjective Christian attached to it by any means, and in that way, it cheapens some of the great lessons that can be learned in the book of Daniel, some of the great lessons that we can learn from him. And so what I want to do in contrast with that, which I think is rather silly, is I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what I'll refer to as the true Daniel plan. Maybe I need to write a book and put that as the title, and maybe I'll sell one or two copies as well. But we're going to talk about that at least in the short period of time that we have this evening. So there are four points that I want to make in the lesson that are very familiar to those of us who have studied the book of Daniel or in any way familiar, even as children, with the story or the narrative of Daniel as it happened during his captivity in Babylon, which of course is where the book of Daniel begins. And we want to again make note of that text there in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8. And it was part of Daniel's plan, as we alluded to, not to defile himself with the king's delicacies or with the wine that was served by the king. He determined not to do that. Now, by the way, I want you to note something, and I neglected to do this because it's somewhat ironic. The Daniel plan is designed to cause an individual to lose weight. But in verse 15 of the text, that after Daniel had determined and was granted the opportunity to drink only water and eat only vegetables for a 10-day period of time, in verse 15, at the end of 10 days, the features of Daniel and his friends appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. I thought that somewhat ironic because they were fattened up a bit more than the others who were eating the king's delicacies. Now, that's not to say that normally drinking water and eating only vegetables is going to fatten you up. It is, however, an indication of the favor that was found on the part of God toward Daniel and his friends because of their faithfulness to him. And so when we talk about God's provision, we talk about God's favor, as we alluded to in our lesson this morning, it is available only to those who are seeking to serve him, only to those who have turned away from unrighteousness. In this particular case, we have Daniel and his friends who were unwilling to begin to do things that were unlawful, things that would defile them, things that would be in contrast to or against the commandments that God had given them as Hebrews. And so that determination, the refusal to violate God's law, to guard themselves against defilement or impurity, is something that certainly we would benefit from to a far greater extent than following a diet plan or exercise plan. Spiritually, we would benefit to a far greater extent by refusing ourselves to defile ourselves with the things that the world has to offer us. And so that's, I think, a good and legitimate point that more properly has a very spiritual application, something to consider. Now, there are three others we want to make note of that are equally beneficial to us. And the second one is found in Daniel, the second chapter. I'd like you to turn with me there. Daniel chapter 2, and we'll begin in verse 16. Of course, this particular section of the study deals with the dream which Nebuchadnezzar had. You'll remember that his first requirement was not that they interpret the dream, but rather that they tell him what the dream was. And of course, if you have charlatans who would simply give their own understanding or own interpretation, that which comes from themselves rather than some divine guidance, then these individuals would have no way of knowing what the dream was. And of course, they told the king that what you're asking us to do is impossible. But in reality, if they truly had a gift of discernment, that is something that was supernatural, it would be as easy for them to discern the dream itself as it would be to discern the interpretation or proper meaning of that dream. And so Nebuchadnezzar was not being unreasonable at all in what he required. But because they could not tell him the dream and they dare not guess, and as such guess wrongly, and as such show themselves to be charlatan, they said, "We cannot tell, and what you require is not possible." Well, he became very angry with them. And not only with them, but putting Daniel in the group with them, had determined to kill all of them because of their inabilities. Of course, Daniel became aware of that. And we are told in verse 16, he went in and he asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. I want you to notice after that, after he had gained some time, he went to his home and he made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or the Babylonian names of those three men. And he made it known to them that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret. So in other words, he's asking for their help to make petitions to God that God would grant them mercy, that they might learn what the secret is. What we're saying is, they went to God and made petitions to God that the secret would be made known. Now, they did not have that ability to discern it themselves. Daniel understood when he went to the king and said, "Give me time." At that point in time, if Nebuchadnezzar had told him, "No, die or tell me now," he couldn't have told him, because he didn't know what the dream was. But he knew that if he went to God and he made petitions and prayers that were righteous, and it be, and this is another point that we're going to emphasize later, in accordance with God's will, that God could show him what it was that he needed to know. And so he made the petition. We are told in verse 19 of the text, the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And so Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and he said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. He changes times and seasons, removes kings, raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things, knows what is in darkness. Light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might and have now made known for me, or to me, what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's demands." Now, with regard to prayer, the trust that David showed to God in offering such a prayer to him. Now we understand, and I do want to acknowledge this, as time has progressed and as the completion of God's scheme of redemption and the fullness of His message to man has been revealed, that it is not proper for us to go to God and ask for God to reveal to us something when God has revealed to us all things that pertain to life and godliness. So we understand and recognize that individuals today who would seek some latter-day revelation, seek some type of inspiration or some knowledge concerning God's will, and they pray for such a still small voice or such a divine wisdom, that they do so inappropriately because of what we have been promised that we have, and that is everything that we need in our day and time. However, having said that, it is right and proper for us to trust in God and to pray for God. And there are other things that we ought to pray to God for, whether it be provision, whether it be for wisdom, whether it be for comfort, whether it be for strength, those things that God has promised us as a part of our prayers that He will grant to us. And that is a good part of the true Daniel plan. as we emulate Him, to pray in faith and trust in God, and recognize as well that He, through His Word, will grant to us everything that we need to know in order to be acceptable to Him. So that's the second point that we want to make. The third one is found in chapter 3. Now, this is not Daniel himself. This is the event where those three friends of Daniel, again known by the name of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, in chapter 3 of the text, came into or brought about the displeasure of Nebuchadnezzar because they refused to compromise their faith. And you'll remember that what happened on that particular occasion, that the king made an image of gold, and its height was 60 cubits, its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dur in the province of Babylon. And the herald would cry out, O people, nations, languages, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with the kinds of music, fall down and worship the gold image that the king of Nebuchadnezzar has set up. You'll remember that those three men, godly men themselves, refused to compromise their faith and bow down to this image. That would be idolatry. That would be sinning against Jehovah God. And these individuals were unwilling to compromise their faith. And I want you to notice the conversation that they had with Nebuchadnezzar. We're told in verse 13 that he was in a rage and fury and gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought the men before the king, and he spoke, and he said to them, Is it true that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Now, I want you to understand something, because it's something bound up in their answer to Nebuchadnezzar. They were not assured of delivery. This challenge which Nebuchadnezzar, that he made concerning their God, whose God is it who will deliver you from my hands? Nebuchadnezzar was exalting himself. He had a problem with that, and God brought him low on a number of occasions, this being one of them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they did not know that that was what would happen. And so their answer was, O Nebuchadnezzar, verse 16, we have no need to answer you in this matter. We don't have to give an answer to you with regard to our worship. He said, if it is the case, our God whom we serve, Jehovah whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. They had confidence that he would. But then they said in verse 18, if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Now I would say again, they had no assurance in the sense that they had not had it revealed to them. There is that expression there, that acknowledgement that it might not happen, found in that last verse of the context. They had confidence that he would. They felt that he would. But it really made absolutely no difference to them with regard to what it was they were willing to do. They were unwilling to compromise no matter what it would cost them. That's a good part of the true Daniel plan. We must maintain the integrity of our faith no matter what. And it may be that as a result of our stand for truth that we will be blessed. It may be that as a result of our stand for what is right and maintaining the integrity of our faith, that there might be provision that is granted us by God on this earth. But not always will that be the case. It may be that while the days seem darkest and the danger presses upon us, that there will be a way of escape made available to us by God's provision. But it may not be. It has not always been the case. You can go from the beginning of the Bible through the entirety of the New Testament. You can look at examples in secular history of Christians who have been persecuted, who have lost their lives as a result of their faith, and were not provided that escape that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were provided on this particular instance. We all know the story. They were thrown into the fiery furnace. Getting them in was enough to cause the death of some men. But they walked about in the midst of the furnace and they were completely unharmed. So God did make provision for them. But that was basically a moot point with regard to whether or not they would do what the king required of them. They would not. If they received God's provision and escaped the judgment of the king, fine and well. But they would not do it regardless, even if it cost them their life. Brethren, that is a very strong faith. You know, I have to admit to the fact that while my faith has been tested on a number of occasions, it has never been tested anywhere close to that extreme. I have made an example from time to time, and it may be that you remember this illustration. I won't go into the specifics of it because it happened in a congregational setting. This congregation but it was years and years and years ago. But I made mention of a time when individuals were saying, number one, false things about some in the congregation, and it was a division which was taking place. And it became necessary for me as I was sitting in the back and others were occupying this place and saying harmful and destructive things that they had to be answered. And this was before that we had elders serving. And I have described to some individuals the sensation that I had. I had finished my preaching. I had stepped down. I was standing at the back. And they were having their say. And I knew that it was necessary that someone answer them. But I had a physical sensation. You hear someone who has no spine or their spine melts. They have no backbone. That literally is the only time I've ever felt that sensation in my life. I hope I never feel it again, but I literally felt like I was about to collapse. That physical sensation. I was wilting. I was melting. And I had to steel myself and come forward and say what needed to be said. Now, some of you know what I'm talking about. Others don't. That's not relevant. It's not relevant to the point. But the point is this. That time, my faith was tested. I hope and pray that I pass that test. We all will have such tests from time to time in our lives, and we need to recognize that's the case. And it is important that we never compromise our faith and our standing with God. When individuals will tempt us to engage in activities, young people understand this. It's what peer pressure is. It gets easier as you get older, but peer pressure never departs. It's something that we all feel from time to time when people want you to go with them and do mischief, engage in acts, do things that God does not approve of. And the desire to fit in, the desire to be welcomed, the desire not to be thought of as peculiar or perhaps to be ridiculed for our faith and our beliefs is there. And it is necessary that we stand strong. When individuals teach error, when brethren are causing strife, when there is a point to be made for righteousness and what is good and what is right. You remember the Apostle Paul with regard to Titus and the difference between the way he conducted himself with regard to the circumcision of Timothy and the lack of circumcision with regard to Titus? With Timothy, he could accommodate because Timothy was a Jew. And so it would do no violence for Timothy as a part of the Jewish culture, as a part of his standing as a Jewish boy or a Jewish man, for him to be circumcised. And he could appease in that way without in any way violating a point of truth. But when it came to Titus was a Gentile. And when individuals said Titus needed to be circumcised, if he were to have allowed that to happen, then the principles of truth for which he stood would have been compromised. And Paul said never. He would not allow it. He withstood them. Because doing otherwise would have been a violation of his faith and the integrity that he held so dear. We need to have that same desire, that same integrity ourselves. Integrity, the word integrity, you know how important that is to us individually? Integrity is a word that is bandied about time and time again. There is, I believe, very few things that are more important than having personal integrity, having a belief system, and having the virtue with regard to that belief system to maintain your fidelity to it, to maintain truthfulness and be true to yourself with regard to what it is you believe. Now, with regard to that, it's important that you believe what is right. But even when the Apostle Paul talks about the conscience, he said, always to heed the dictates of your conscience. Whatever is not of faith is a sin. If I were to engage in some activity that I think to be wrong, even if it not in reality wrong, because I don't have the personal integrity to stand upon my values and I do something that violates my idea of right and wrong, I've sinned there because I have violated my integrity. I violated my conscience. I've not remained true to myself. Integrity is extremely important. With regard to our faith, regard to what we believe as being of utmost importance, of right and wrong, of righteousness as contrasted with unrighteousness, of good as contrasted with evil, of that which brings us into standing with God versus that which separates us from God. Righteousness and sin. We need to have integrity. We need to make sure that we do not compromise our faith. That's a wonderful aspect of the true Daniel plan that we would do well to emulate. The fourth and final one we want to make note of. Again, we're going back to Daniel. It's in chapter 6. And this is another situation where Daniel personally was in danger as a result of his practice. On this particular occasion, it was Darius now, rather than Nebuchadnezzar. And, of course, you'll remember that there were some jealousies with regard to Daniel because of the high esteem in which he was held. And so a trap was set. And this proclamation would be that no one would pray to anyone else other than to Darius the king. But you'll notice the governors, verse 6, and the satraps thronged before the king, said thus to him, King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, administrators, satraps, the counselors, and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm declaration that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. So, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Now, understand this. It was a trap because Darius... It's a peculiar thing to say this, but when Darius made a law, Darius could not set aside the law. He was the supreme ruler, but because of Medo-Persian law, as the supreme ruler, when he dictated something, he couldn't back out on it. That was the nature of the law. Darius understood that and signed that law, signed that written decree. Well, what happened with Daniel? The reason why they had come about to decree this was because they knew it was Daniel's practice to pray to God three times a day. So the law was passed, and Daniel, just as he did in Daniel the first chapter in verse 8, where he refused to be defiled by the king's delicacies, we're told in verse 10 that when Daniel knew, this is the interesting thing, waited, saw that Darius had signed the petition. Okay, now I know that that is against the law. I know now I know that if I go and do what I have been doing, and I open up my window, and I pray, that that will cause me to be thrown into the den of lions. I understand the Persian law. I understand the consequences of what I'm doing. Now that I know that, Daniel knew the writing was signed. What did he do? He went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as was his custom since the early days. Did the exact same thing. Now, the application, of course, of that, and I think perhaps the primary one is the same application we just made with regard to the previous declaration of Daniel chapter 3 with regard to the three men. That is, do not compromise your faith. And Daniel certainly did not. But I want you to understand the significance of what it was he did every day and how strengthening that was for him. I don't know how many times I've talked to individuals who will tell me they really struggle with getting to every service. They struggle with worldliness. They struggle with various temptations. And when you look at those individuals who express such struggles with those various things, almost invariably, they do not have righteous habits. They have not inculcated into their daily regimen these disciplines of study and of meditation and of prayer. And it is to a very great extent directly because of their lack of discipline with regard to righteous habits that they struggle so mightily with the temptation and trials of life. I'm reminded of Galatians, the 5th chapter. We've talked many times about the lust of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit. And we talk about them and we list them and we spend time defining what they are, what to avoid, and what to involve ourselves in. But Paul's primary point in that is that if you establish these fruits of the Spirit, if they become part of your nature and character, to where the Spirit has the upper hand in your life, His directions have molded your character in your life. As a result of that, because you have immersed yourself in the fruits of the Spirit, you will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. You talk about what is, in effect, a tug of war. Interesting thing. Rabbi used to, on occasion, they would have various pseudo-sporting events on ABC or one of the other deals, and sometimes it would be celebrities, sometimes it would be athletes put in a different deal, but whenever those things came about, almost always there was a tug of war. And so you'd have two teams that were set up. They may be opposing networks, they might be opposing NFL teams, they may be opposing football versus baseball or whatever, and they would have a tug of war, and you'd have 8 men on each side. And they would dig down in the sand. And the amazing thing was to watch if they were evenly matched. They would have to go away to a commercial and they would have to do time-lapse photography, and there would be maybe an hour or 2 hours where they were struggling, and you have the ribbon in the middle of the rope, and you have the two lines where if it gets past one line or the other, you have the winner, and it'd be back and forth a little bit. But it was in stasis almost. There was an equilibrium with regard to the forces that were being put upon this to where it didn't move. How many of us have that as a good description of our lives? To where we've got the flesh lusting against the Spirit and the Spirit against the flesh, and they're almost equally strong. So sometimes the flesh is a little stronger. Sometimes the Spirit's a little stronger. But we never get a hold of it to where we're in control. We're never to the point to where we are confident. Never to the point where we're strong. And I'm not talking about arrogance. I'm not talking about pride. I'm not talking about the individual who thinks he stands, and as such, he is ripe for being overcome by the devil. If any man thinks he stands, let him take heed lest he falls. We're not talking about arrogance. We're talking about an individual who has diligently applied to himself those necessary disciplines to grow as a child of God to the point to where the devil's losing big time. To where in that tug of war there is a very decided victor in these various struggles that hit us in our life. The devil throws that temptation and we laugh at it. Because though there that enticement is present, and though it may very well have had a problem or caused a problem in the past and had an effect on us in the past, no longer does it touch us because we have learned and we've been strengthened by diligence in our efforts as a child of God. We're not talking about sinless perfection. We're talking about Christian maturity. And the fact that Christian maturity is something that is reachable for each and every one of us. If we strive daily to exercise ourselves spiritually, be diligent to present yourself a worker that needs not be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. That's diligence in study. Pray without ceasing. That's diligence in prayer. Meditate on the Lord. Think on these things. Philippians chapter 4. Diligence and meditation. These are things that are all helpful for us and a part of a very good Daniel plan that will benefit us as it benefited Daniel and his friends in the few chapters that we've looked up to this point in time. So, of course, we could go in other people's lives. We could go throughout the rest of the book of Daniel and come across a number of different examples. But I just wanted to contrast that ridiculous facade, facsimile of what true Christianity is, where you have individuals who are selling diet books and saying that this is some kind of a, a spiritual ministry of something important, and in reality what the Bible's all about, what the messages ought to be to impact us spiritually in our lives. And so as we draw our lesson to a close and conclusion, we want to make note of the fact that if we do these things, if we follow the true Daniel plan, to use that illustration more clearly, then we truly will be rewarded. And we have that example of Daniel being rewarded there in that text. You remember that overnight, Daniel was in the den of lions. The king gave the command because he did not want, in this case, Daniel to be thrown, but it was the law. So he had Daniel thrown in, but overnight, we're told the king went to his palace, spent the night fasting, rose the next morning, verse 19, went to haste to the den of lions. When he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. A lamenting voice. He worried about it. He was afraid that that was the end of his friend. But he said, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" And Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you." And the king was exceedingly glad. Notice verse 23. The king was exceedingly glad for him, commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him. Why? Because he believed in his God. Now I can't promise to you that you'll never be harmed physically because of your faith in God. But I do promise you this, that if you are faithful to Him, that provision will be afforded you to eternal life. And there is no greater reward than we can receive. So I hope and pray that these things have been beneficial to you this evening. I thought it kind of an interesting dichotomy and a good contrast to bring up some salient and important points. We're going to offer an invitation at this time, not knowing the hearts of any. If you're here this evening, not a child of God, as we said this morning, so we offer again the opportunity for you to respond to the gospel call. If you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, then repent of your sins, confess Him as Lord, be baptized to have your sins washed away. The promise has been given to you of redemption, the remission of sins, the hope of life. If as a child of God there is something amiss in your life, you want to make it right, then we'll offer you the opportunity to do so as well. If we can assist you in any way to answer that invitation call, we ask that you come. While together we stand, while we sing.